Blog Talk Radio.
UFO Paranormal and Mystical Insight. Tonight, Steve Katz is leading us in a topic
greetings, everybody.
Called Health and Religious Freedom. What was the real reason behind the prosecution of the Branch Davidians? Good. Hello, Steve. Good evening.
Hi. Hi, Ruth Ann. It's a pleasure to be on this broadcast again and to discuss these issues which are suppressed in the mainstream media quite a bit, ignored, and tried to be airbrushed out of the history books.
Well, they've pretty much, they've gone beyond airbrushing them. They, it's just straight up lies. So
yep.
What the kids now are learning.
I don't know. They go down the memory hole, you know, like in 1984, Winston, you know, they tell them to crumble it up and throw it out and rewrite it. That's all.
Totally. It's really, that's what I tell people, that I'm having to learn the real history now,
right,
because I
right.
didn't get it when I was in school. So, once you start getting glimpses of the truth, You know that so much of your life has been based on lies and things you just assumed
were true.
And, I mean, that's something really to come to terms with. So,
yeah, well, it's a good education, and the earlier you get it, the better, because we have to think for ourselves and make our own decisions and analyze our own evidence and do whatever we can to come to our own conclusions, and that is the only way democracy can work.
Exactly. And now we're so blessed because we have so much information at our fingertips. And so it's very important to be discerning and, just explore it for yourself. We're not saying just take our word. We're saying, hey, we've looked it up and this is what we've come to. And we really like for people to do that for themselves.
I tell people, do your own thinking. Don't take my word for it, and don't take the government's word for it.
Exactly. I would say particularly don't take the government's. You know, just like everything else, you know, we say follow the money. Well, that's pretty much this. You know, follow the intent. Like, why does mainstream media just spew out these lies consistently? What's the intent? You know, who's backing them? Where is the money?
Well, I mean, of course, you know, the money, the lies are to protect the money.
Sure. And to protect a government that always needs an enemy.
Right.
So they always be at, quote-unquote, war. And that's, you know, how these cases we're going to talk about, particularly David Koresh and the Branch Davidians,
right.
You know, it wasn't called war, but that's exactly what it was.
Yes. Well, it most definitely was a military engagement between what I would characterize as a religious militia and the armed forces of the American state. There's no question in my mind.
Yeah. And there was no, you know, anybody who says, well, they had to take him out, blah, blah, blah. He was a child molester, he this and this and this. And he had, up until this time, been on pretty decent terms with the law there in Texas. He had been in court a couple times. He was found not guilty of child molestation and a couple other things. And, you know, because he went to court, he would do this. There was no reason for the federal government to come out to this home of all these people and eventually set it on fire and murder all these people.
Well, I mean, I can tell you that from what I understand, the law in Texas at the time was that a homesteader or anybody in their home could use sufficient force to repel the police or any other law enforcement troops if they were trying an illegal entry in order to protect themselves. And that, I understand, was the law at the time that David Koresh and his co-religionists, they only opened fire after the Bureau of Tobacco and Firearms stormed their compound, and they were and they had quite a few women and children at risk, and
and actually somebody from the home had called the police department. I mean, I've heard the tapes. I'm sure you have, telling them to stop. That there's women and kids in there, and you know that somebody's outside attacking them.
Yes, well, I mean, at the time, there was a fellow, I can't recall his name, happened to be a graduate of Harvard Law School, but the essential point is he was a lawyer, and he was also a religious follower of David Koresh, and he was Koresh's, I would call him an in-house lawyer. He lived in the community, but, you know, he tried to take care of their legal affairs. He made a phone call stating that, you know, they were being attacked and there were women and children in the house. That phone call, I don't know who it went to, but it had no effect.
Absolutely. Well, because the mind is made up. They had decided to do this. Now,
right.
A year before, because this began in February of 1993, and it culminated 51 days later when the feds burned the home.
Right.
In 1992, in northern Idaho, some of the same people attacked Randy Weber and his wife, killing her and their infant, and they even killed the dog, you know, for just stupid reasons. And I can remember seeing pictures of the neighbors of the Weber family trying to block the road to keep the ATF out. And it was horrendous. These people were minding their own business. They were way out in the boonies. And
why did they go out there after them?
Well, there were all kinds of, actually, I think it was a test case myself, but they used the excuse of non-payment of taxes, and then also something about arms. And the thing was, this man had no more arms or ammunition than anyone else in the area. And
right.
They, you know, they went to town every few weeks, every month, whatever, to get supplies and things. But there again, if they wanted him, they had a chance to get him. They didn't have to do this attack. And for a man and his wife, a little boy, a baby girl, and an older girl, and their neighbor, well, actually, I guess he was staying there then, a young man and a dog. They called out this huge contingent. You know, so I think it was a case of just a test to see how the American people would react. And
well, as I understand in the Koresh case, the Bureau of Tobacco and Firearms was coming up for funding,
yes.
And
yes,
they wanted to stage a spectacular incident in order to bring it to the public's mind, because it was the same thing there. I mean, David Koresh was known, as well as the people who were living out there. I would characterize their living arrangements, myself coming out of the 1960s, as a religious commune. But it was definitely a commune where you had adults and children living together, families and so on. And people used to come in and out of town for all kinds of reasons. And Koresh frequently went to town, and you know, for mail, and for sometimes he had favorite restaurants. He also had a band. And he could have been arrested at any time in town, and I'm sure he would not have resisted in any way as a single individual.
He never did. I mean, when, you know, he
And not only that, but the I saw a tape that was made in the 1990s. I saw it a couple of years ago. The local library in my community has a copy of it. It's never been put into DVD. It's one of those things where I think they're trying to put it down a memory hole. But my local library here had an old copy which had part of the congressional investigation hearings into the Branch Davidian tragedy. And, you know, in there, there's all kinds of questioning as to why they did what they wanted to do. And they interviewed, and also the filmmakers, whom I don't know, but they put together a pretty good documentary. They went to visit the sheriff in the local town there in Waco, Texas, about the situation out at the Waco compound. And he had only very positive things to say about them. He said they were always unfailingly polite, and, you know, they never created any type of problem in the town or anywhere else.
Right.
And that he did get reports eventually. There were some disaffected Australian followers who filed various complaints and came out with various stories. Now, David Koresh, apparently, like some of the old Mormons, he did have more than one wife. Let's put it this way, he did have more than one relationship, but they questioned the sheriff about this, and the sheriff said, look, we knew that, you know, he had relationships, and sometimes with young women, 14, 15. He said the law of Texas at that time was that an adolescent at that age could get married with their parents' consent in terms of they recognized common law marriage in Texas at that time. I think the laws have changed, and I'm not from Texas, and I'm not, you know, I practice law in New York, so I'm just telling you what I heard on the what the sheriff was saying, who was a very nice guy. He reminded me of those, you know, old sheriffs like Matt Dillon, and, you know, he was a very reasonable, decent man, you know, a very straight guy, and someone who respected other people's freedom. In other words, you know, and he was saying, look, they were on their own land and all this. But to make a long story short, he says, listen, he says, the few relationships that I knew of, or one or two in particular, he was talking about, I think he was talking about one in particular, he says, look, the parents are there on the compound, they know about the relationship, and they have consented to it. And he said, and at that age, and under the law of Texas at that time, there was nothing we could do about it because it was legal.
And it was really nobody else's business. Yeah, exactly.
And the Department of Social Services went out there, they investigated, and they found no abuse, and they found nothing amiss with the children out there. And also in the congressional hearings, it was very interesting because there was a congressman from New Mexico. I can't think of his name at the time, but he was one of the few congressmen who seriously pressed the federal government on the sightings of U.S. UFOs. He was from New Mexico, and he was on that subcommittee. And, of course, as you know, there's a lot of UFO sightings in New Mexico. But anyway, he's a congressman from that area, and he was on the committee. And he went through all the legal papers that the Bureau of Fire and Tobacco Arms and the affidavits they had filed, you know, in order to get the authority to attack the compound. And he's reading to the agents who are responsible, maybe, you know, the higher-ups, as well as those who carried out the raids, but also the higher-ups, and he's who have to approve it, because, you know, nothing like this gets done in any federal agency or even state agencies unless somebody signs off on it, you know, at a high level, whether it's the captain or, you know, whatever, who's ever in charge, the supervising agent or, you know. And he says, look, he says, I see a lot of information here about sexual activities at the compound. And he said, as far as I know, the Bureau of Fire and Tobacco of Firearms has no jurisdiction over sexual matters, do they?
Exactly.
And it was there in black and white. He says, I can't believe that this is in here. What does this have to do with the storing of illegal firearms? He said,
exactly.
I'm a little bit puzzled by this. Maybe you can explain it to me, you know?
Yeah.
And that reminded me about the case of Wilhelm Reich again, because, you know, it's, and then you even could go further because, just like in the Reich case, you know, you had unusual theories. I mean, the Branch Davidians were a splinter that goes back to the 19th century Seventh-day Adventists or Millerites who expected an apocalypse and who were strong on both prophecy and apocalypse. And, you know, there was a whole history to it, but David Koresh had his own version of it. And it's not unusual for religious movements to have various different schools of thought. I mean, and his was one of them, you know, and it was unusual. And also what was unusual is it's very rare in this day and age for people to really attempt on a day-to-day basis to live their religious beliefs in that way. In other words, 24/7, you know, people do go to church and synagogue and many do, in good faith, attempt to carry out the precepts of their faiths, but it's rare in this country, unless you're part of a religious order where, you know, you're living in a monastery or in a seminary or some other place,
right,
to actually spend all your time, to have whole families living together. And Koresh would give what he called studies. He would speak on the Bible for sometimes 8-10 hours at a time, any time of the day and night. And they pressed him because he was very stimulating, he had a lot of insights, and, you know. But the only reason I bring this up is because I suspect that under the guise of some of these other laws which are in place, and they have rational reasons to be in place, they're misused to go after people whose beliefs and activities the conventional society just gets frightened by it or doesn't understand it or, you know, thinks it's bizarre in some ways. And, of course, under the First Amendment, we have religious freedom. We're free to believe whatever we want. We're not free to do whatever we want, but we're certainly free to believe whatever we want. I mean, within, inside the confines of what's required under secular law. And it seems to me in some of these cases, people were targeted as much for their beliefs as for their activities.
Oh, definitely, definitely. I just recently found out that back in the 1800s, I think it was the 1840s, the governor of the state of Missouri had an extermination act out against Mormons.
God.
And can you imagine, you know, you hear the word extermination, you automatically think of World War II. But this preceded that by 100 years. And Mormons have always been chased across this country and ending up in Utah. But they were in this particular town just pretty much herded up into a wooden, loggish building. And the forces there just took their muskets, their rifles, whatever they had, and, you know, this was not well chinked, let's put it that way, and they just shot into this building until all the Mormons were dead, and this was fine. I mean, this was it, and that's horrifying. I've known so many Mormons, particularly when I lived in the West, and as a group, I mean, I can totally say these are wonderful people, and I don't mean...
Right.
Mitt Romney necessarily, but that they're very family oriented. Hard workers, very willing to share.
Yeah.
I really like Mormons. And when I found that out, but I know that here in Illinois, they were chased out of Nauvoo, Illinois. Actually, they were burned out. And, you know, now there's a nice, big, beautiful temple there. just a few years old. But they've always been chaste in this country. And, I mean, up until now, they're not persecuted that much now. Because now we have Muslims we can persecute.
Well, and it's the same thing. You know, you suspect that it goes, some of these laws are definitely pushed and used to go after the people's beliefs.
Yes,
you know.
Yes. Yeah, more than.
And personally, I can think of no more egregious violation of the First Amendment than to place informers inside religious institutions, even inside mosques. It doesn't have to be mosques. It could be a church. It could be, you know, a compound or anything else. I mean, that's a direct intrusion of the state into the religious activity of U.S. citizens in contravention of the First Amendment. And I don't think there's any way you can interpret it otherwise, unless something has happened. I mean, if a crime is being committed at that time, or let's say illegal substances are being stored in a religious sanctuary, and the police authorities can convince a judge to issue them a warrant based on evidence and probable cause and so on, that's one thing. But to put informants in an ongoing basis inside these places, that's a direct violation of religious freedom. You know.
Right. That's what we have in so many of our mosques now. People have been embedded there. Also, not maybe so much now, but in the past, a lot of the black churches in this country were infiltrated. Not necessarily churches who were doing anything wrong, but during the hot times in the country, they thought that a lot was coming from black preachers. And so...
Right.
They were spied upon, and
I can tell you that I have a book on it that was published recently, dealing with Malcolm X. I mean, Malcolm X's FBI file so large it was enough for the publication of a hardback book, and they had people following him around and sitting in on things he said, and you know, and an intrusion into the exercise of his religious beliefs. There's no question in my mind, you know.
Yeah. It's horrible when you think about this. Now, there were a couple other, you'd use the word in the title, cults, and Heaven's Gate comes to mind. As far as I really don't know much about that, except that there again they had some different beliefs, and I believe that they had been infiltrated near the end, but not enough for anybody to do anything to keep them from killing themselves. Then we can't forget Jonesboro in Guyana, Jim Jones.
Jonestown. Well, Jonesboro. I mean, the cult, the essence of the thing is this, and it's a very fine line, and this is where the violation of religious freedom comes in. Cult, strictly speaking, has to do with people who are being held against their will by a group of people through methods of psychological control, brainwashing, and physical methods. That's what a cult is. Yeah. But having a religious belief which is outside the mainstream does not make it a cult.
No.
And there again, we've had the misuse of this concept of cult. You know, and there are so-called deprogrammers who are hired by parents who I'm sure, you know, mean well and are very terrified and are worried about their children and their, even their adult children. What are they doing in these, you know, with these, you know, the Heaven's Gate or some other thing. But, you know, once somebody is an adult and they've formulated their own religious beliefs and spiritual philosophy, they're entitled to it. And, to hire a deprogrammer, I think, you can hire a private detective to find out if it looks like they're on their own free will. But once it's been determined that they're there on their own free will, or you cannot convince the authorities or an independent judge or magistrate that they're not there by their own free will, they have to be allowed to be left to practice their religion.
Exactly. Well, I'll tell you something that you may not have known. Some time ago, I was living not exactly in a commune, but something similar. This has been probably eight or 9 years ago. And all of a sudden, I mean, I was teaching a class, right? And somebody came back and said, you know, can you, you know, leave them for a little bit? And the two of the policemen from the town I lived in were there. And some of my relatives had gotten in touch with them and wanted to make sure I wasn't being held against my will. And let me tell you, I was so upset. It's like, what the hell? You know, and so the cops asked me a few questions, and they saw that I was fine. I didn't speak to my relatives for over a year, but I can't
tell. Well, how old were you at the time?
This was only 8 or 9 years ago.
That's a little bit puzzling.
That was just a little bizarre for them to do this. And like I said, I didn't speak to them for a year, and we've never really talked about it. Because, I mean, I know that their intentions were whatever, but I can't tell you quite how that made me feel, but, you know, so I can't imagine how just a young person would feel when, you know, they made their own decisions, they're doing what they want, and then here come the police or somebody tries to steal them away because somebody else doesn't like what they're doing or that they're being brainwashed?
Well, here again, we go through a fine line. I mean, I draw a line between teenagers and adults.
I think
the threshold is less. I think if you have a teenager, even, you know, perhaps near the age of majority or even, you know, like below the age of 20, I think, you know, some reasonable investigation may be warranted because, let's face it, adolescents are very impressionable and you want to find out and so on and so on. And but even in that case, you have to, you know, I mean, if the person is old enough to live on their own and they're old enough to sign contracts to provide for their own necessities and upkeep, then by all legal intents and purposes, they're independent and they can make their own decisions. Now, if there's some evidence that something untoward is happening, it can be investigated and so on and so forth. But, of course, as a person gets older and older, you really have the evidentiary threshold, in my mind, goes up because, you know, if you got somebody who's 40 years old living in a group, I mean, you know, you have to have some pretty hard evidence and some pretty clear indication that they're being held against their will or they're being enslaved or whatnot, you know. I mean, it's nice to have relatives who are concerned, but a lot of people are very controlling. And also, then you cross over the line because, word comes back what do these people believe. Like the Branch Davidians believed, and it did not start with David Koresh. It started with a guy named Miller way, way back in the 19th century. I mean, in the early 19th century, where he was a man of some means, and he was able to take time out to really study the Bible, and he came to the conclusion, you know, that the prophets were predicting an apocalypse, and he had a following of, I don't know, at one time maybe 100,000 people. I mean, you know, but his doctrine was unusual, you know, an unusual religious doctrine. In fact, the First Amendment, its real core is the protection of unpopular religions. I mean, that's why it was put up there, because in Europe you had state religions, and if you didn't belong to the state religion, you suffered detriment. Sometimes you couldn't vote, you couldn't go into certain professions or lines of work. I mean, it had a lot of ramifications. So when the people came here, and many people came here fleeing oppression in Europe, and they said, we have to have a law down here that says, you know, you're free to practice your faith, and this should not disqualify you from holding public office or, doing what any other citizen or individual in our country can do. And now, you know, with this cult stuff. Now, of course, you know, it's a two-way street to a certain extent, because when you have an incident like Jonestown, all the red flags go up, and then you get an overreaction.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? Because, I mean, the worst thing that happened with the Millerites is he predicted that the world was going to end, I think, in 1844. And as far as I know, we're still on the world, and we're alive, and we're here. So obviously that didn't happen. So a lot of his followers became disillusioned. But that's a different story. Jonestown people died. I mean, Heaven's Gate people died. Now, the Branch Davidians would not have died. They would have been fine. They were going along fine. I mean, we don't know what eventually would have happened. It might have broken up, you know, the sects do break up, or it just might have continued, you know. But, you know, you get into this area, and when you get into the area of the use of force, you really have to know what you're doing, and you really have to clear a clear picture of what is going on. And, you know, hysterical relatives or people out in the community who think they're dealing with Dr. Frankenstein, and there's a mob of people with torches, you know, running after him because, you know, they don't know what's going on, and they think it's fearful, and it fits into a complex of events which have happened over the past number of years, in which we have been losing one freedom after another, and now, you know, certain religious beliefs are coming under attack, including more mainstream beliefs are coming under attack. And as a Jewish person, I sometimes don't feel as comfortable as I used to be. I feel there's much more anti-Semitism in the world than there used to be. And, you know, once you start going down this road, you're not heading in any good direction. So there's a lot of people of goodwill and good faith who, you know, try to mitigate these things. But, you know, we're starting to lose all of our rights.
Well, I think when it comes to the government, they, you know, they will mouth whatever about religious freedom, but they really just want people who follow dogma. They don't want any kind of religion that is encouraging people to think for themselves or to do anything that may just not be part of the approved religion. Oh. And in this country, that used to be Christianity and the Jewish religion. But like you said, now that's not even if you're part of those religions and you're maybe thinking for yourself, they don't like that because they've used religion, the approved religions, as the opium of the masses. And when you're trying to get off that drug and looking for more, they don't like it. So we shouldn't be surprised considering the way, like you said, so many rights are being taken away. But yet,
there's been an assault on, a systematic assault on critical thought.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not suggesting that it's all coordinated. It's part of the zeitgeist, to use a term that, you know, is not much used anymore. Things just seem to get more and more repressive. You take a look at those old, they're not so old, but they're old now, of the old DVDs of the police and the other authorities at the Occupy sites, and the types of beatings that people were given for exercising their right to dissent is just horrible.
Yes.
And the types of things that went on, including out in Oakland. But then, of course, now it goes into every realm of life, you know, and I remember a line that I like to quote from Easy Rider, the old 60s movie with Peter Fonda and Jack Nicholson, and which, you know, has become a classic. You know, Jack Nicholson is a Southern lawyer, and Peter Fonda and Dennis Hopper get arrested in a small town because, you know, they got long hair, they look weird, and, you know, they ended up riding along in a parade, and the police arrested them and put them in jail. But to make a long story short, Nicholson was also in there sleeping off a drunken bender, and he got them out, and... you know, he says, I've always wanted to go to New Orleans. So to make a long story short, they took him on their bikes, and they were out in the desert, you know, one night because the hotels out there, the motels didn't want to take them. They looked like bikers. They were afraid to take them. They didn't take them. Well, they were bikers, but they were, you know, they were not menacing or anything. They were not, you know, so they went out into the desert, and there was a discussion. And, you know, Nicholson and Hopper get into this discussion about freedom. And, you know, Hopper is saying, this is great, you know. I mean, you know, freedom is, you know, really great and so on. And how come, you know, we go places and, you know, because we're expressing ourselves, you know, we get into hassles. We get arrested. We can't get hotel rooms. And so Nicholson said, look, they'll talk to you about freedom day and night. They'll mention freedom and how freedom is great value and how we're fighting for freedom. He says, but they, if they see a really free person, it's going to frighten them.
Yeah.
And so Hopper says, well, isn't this what it's all about? I mean, you know, so... you know, what effect should it have on them? And Hopper and Nicholson says, when they get frightened, they become dangerous.
Yes.
And I think that points out the entire difference between freedom as an ideology, which is printed on a page, and free people who are freely functioning. There's a big difference between those two concepts. And some of these beliefs that people don't understand, and they become frightened by them, and they become dangerous. And when those people are in government and have a lot of power and armed forces behind them, having somebody who is a frightened, dangerous person in control of an armed force, which we found out with a man named Hitler, doesn't always result in a good situation.
No, absolutely.
And, you know, so there are many, many issues here, but what concerns me more than anything else is that we are losing our freedoms. And we pay for these freedoms in a lot of different ways. That we don't have the security that a lot of societies have because we have freedom. That means there's a lot of risk-taking. There's a lot of lack of security, but we have mobility and we have freedom. Now, we pay a price for that, you know.
Yes.
If you wanted to live in a society where, you know, everything was absolutely guaranteed, you wouldn't have the same degree of freedom because whoever was giving you those guarantees would be making sure that you believed a certain thing and you acted in a certain way. Otherwise, you couldn't survive. So a lot of people, you know, if you're paying the price, then you should enjoy the benefits of it, you know.
Well,
and corporations are not people.
No, no matter what they say. What you say is true because anytime that something's given to you, there will be strings attached. Now, also, though, if we had a guaranteed income and free education, this kind of thing would free people up to be creative and to spend time as they chose with their families, with their friends, writing a book, painting a picture, making music, so that they would have more freedom to, in the creative sense, because they wouldn't be worrying so much about paying the rent, paying these atrocious costs for college, et cetera. So there again, there would be a it offsets.
Well, there's some truth in that, but there's a very great danger there. History tells us that people who have power become corrupt.
They will
also abuse their power. Whoever is guaranteeing that income has absolute power over the population.
Well, it has to be the population.
That person, but that's not the way it's going to happen. It would be a tyranny, because whoever controlled that guaranteed income and whoever controlled that guaranteed society, whether it was a political party or the state or whatever, would have absolute power over the people.
Exactly. You know, it doesn't have to be that way, because people can take power. But people have been...
Yeah, but what people is an abstraction. People don't take power. People take power in the name of the people. And the people who take power in the name of the people end up abusing that power.
Oh, it works that way.
That's the problem.
Right, because...
That's the problem.
Because right now, we have, in this country, in the United States, we have all these senators and representatives, and I choke when I say representatives because they're not representing anyone I know, but who have taken it upon themselves because we gave them the power, we voted them in, or let them be bought in, whatever.
Yeah, but I'll tell you something, it would be a lot worse if we had to depend on them for housing and food.
Oh, for sure.
It would be a lot worse.
Depend on them for jack shit. Because
people have to be... I'm saying, it's more of a question. Freedom means that a freedom of existential self-determination. No state can guarantee it. All the state can do is repress and exploit and tell you which side of the road to drive on. That's all it can do. And it can, of course, provide some positive things in terms of regulating, seeing that banks are legitimate and fraud and all this kind of thing and that roads are repaired and there are schools. But, I mean, beyond that, the individual existentially must be free to chart their own course. Otherwise, they're going to be under some form of tyranny. Now,
you're talking about, this is true. But the other side of it is when people are totally free, with the mindset that people are in right now, and I do admit that vibrations are rising, people are becoming more internationalist. They see this, some people, but others are too greedy in their own selves. If you just say, okay, I'm going to be libertarian and everybody can just go off and do their own thing, that's not going to work either, because I always give the example. I personally like kiwi fruit from New Zealand, okay? Now, if I don't have any kind of structure in my life, socially, trade-wise, whatever, I'm never going to see another kiwi. So
yeah, but that's not libertarianism. That anything taken to an absolute can turn into its opposite.
Sure.
There's an individual in this society. There are legitimate societal functions that have to be cooperatively and collectively provided for. If everyone wanted to decide what traffic rules to obey, we would have utter chaos.
Yeah.
So there are things that have to be. But there are other freedoms that we have to determine for ourselves. I mean, if a person, it's just like the whole thing. There's a lot of moralism on television about people who don't want to go into shelters. Now, a lot of people are afraid to go into shelters because it can be dangerous there. But at the same time, some people, they don't want to be regulated with security guards and all kinds of things you have to put up with in shelters. They want to live. Have found their own way of living on the street. Some of them have found, have constructed little habitations in abandoned railroad tunnels and under bridges and in other places.
Sure.
Some of them are itinerants. Some of them sleep on subways. Now, there is a danger when the weather gets very cold and you know, there is an interest in, that society as a whole has in seeing that people don't freeze to death or anything like this. But within limits, within reasonable limits, people should be free to choose that.
I agree.
You know what I'm saying? I mean, yep. And that's what I'm talking about. You know, that we don't have, you know, a situation where people lose that existential freedom of choice, which is so important in our lives, that we are free. If we don't like where we're working, we're free to walk the hell out of there. We're free to tell the boss to you know what, and get out. Now, you know, and if it takes going to another state or even going to another country, we can get out of the situation. But if you're in a situation where you're assigned to a job for life, and if you try to get out, you're going to be thrown into some kind of prison or re-education camp or something, you are not free.
Absolutely not. I don't know of any.
So, you know, and that's why I say people think of freedom, and they only think of freedom in the sense of materialist freedom. Freedom means I can accumulate as many goods as I want. Nobody's going to tell me how much to consume and how much to accumulate. And that's true. That is a part of freedom. But that's not the only part of freedom. There's another part, is the freedom to choose how to live your life, which encompasses a lot more than that and is much more important than that, because material wealth can be won and lost and can be gained or lost. But the freedom to, within human limits, to determine your own life, including your own religious beliefs, is extremely important.
Exactly.
You know,
and that goes right back to the cults, as far as, you know, as far as I know, peoples in Heaven's Gate could have left if they wanted to.
Right.
In Mount Carmel, down by Waco, at that home there, people could have left. And now, Jim Jones, though, this is a little different. You know, he had started out in Illinois or Indiana, and then he moved west, gathering more people. And when they went to Guyana, part of the attraction for him, from what I've read about the People's Temple, was that people would be cut off from their families and everything. And in fact, he practiced some of that in California. Like you said, using psychological mind control methods and things.
Then
got them down there. I mean, they were pretty trapped. So that was a different kind of cult?
Yeah, that's a different situation. See, that goes into a circumstance where I feel it forms more into the definition of a cult, where you have people who are frightened and are no longer in control of their own lives and are, in effect, being coerced, sometimes with the use of arms, sometimes with the use of psychological control. Now, Jim Jones was a psychopath. I mean, I'm not a psychiatrist. I don't want to diagnose him, but he was very, very far from any reasonable definition of mental normality, health, or whatever you want to call it. And even as defined in this society, which is not a very high bar to reach, he was off the boards. I mean, he was completely off the boards. And, you know, it started in the 60s. It was a great idea, the People's Temple, People's Religions, where, you know, you didn't have all these hierarchies and restrictions, and, you know, people were living together and they were participating and so on and so forth. But Koresh, and, you know, you can interview any of the survivors of of David Koresh, the people who lived there with him, and there are still people there who follow that belief and that faith, and they live in the area. And he did not require his people to stay there. They could leave at any time.
Yes.
You know? Now, he had a thing, some kind of vision. He went to Israel. He had a vision because the Davidians, the branch Davidians, but there was also Seventh-day Adventist Davidians, which a guy named Victor Hautef formed in the 1930s. And then there was the original Seventh-day Adventist church, and they all exist together. But one of the beliefs was in an apocalypse and in a revelation and so on and so forth, and that a certain number of people were going to be saved and so on. And he went to Israel because the Branch Davidians, and even going back to the Seventh-day Adventists, had a very close affinity with Judaism in terms of their beliefs. They believe that, you know, you should observe the Jewish Sabbath on a Saturday, not on a Sunday, and the feast days, and they had a very close affinity with Israel because the apocalyptic events were to take place in Israel or in that area. Now, he had some kind of vision. He came back and he said that, well, he felt he was the Lamb, and the Lamb has been interpreted by various theologians as a Christ-like figure, if not Christ himself, depending on what theology you're following. And but there was supposed to be a group of people there that were pure, that were going to ascend at the second coming after some sort of interval of 1,000 years or something. And to make a long story short, he came back and announced that, you know, all the men henceforth had to be could not engage in carnal relations with their wives, or that they had to be pure, they had to be virginal, and therefore he was going to take their place with their wives. So he said, if you want to stay here, you know, this revelation was given to me that, you know, I'm going to have the wives. You guys, you're too good to have wives. No, this is true. This happened. You're going to be very pure, and I'm going to have all of your wives. Well, some of them went along with it, but some of them didn't quite like the idea, which is not it is not surprising that
exactly.
He was going to take everybody's wives, and but it was for their benefit. That was not for his benefit. So, I don't know. The guy managed to father 19 kids, so, you know, quite a few people stuck with him. But he didn't stop anybody from leaving, and a number of people did leave, including, I think, some of the Australians left at that time. And I think at that point, anybody with any marbles would say to themselves, look, you know, this is now crossing the line. I'll buy some of your Bible cassettes, but, you know, I don't think I'm going to live here anymore.
Right.
You know, because, I mean, what sane person is going to believe this?
But that's their right. I mean, they could leave, and he didn't try to force anyone.
But he didn't stop anybody. Oh. Anybody who wanted could leave. He did sometimes ask people if they got close to him and they wanted to really be involved in his life, he asked them to live there. But if they said they didn't want to live there, he told them to get out. In fact, there was an informant living among them. There was an informant who, you know, was later there, I suppose, there. Archetype of Judas, who actually was an informant for the Bureau of Fire and Tobacco and Firearms or whatever, joined up and was living there. And when they found out about it, David Koresh came to him and said, you know what, just leave. We're not going to do anything to you, and we're not going to condemn you. We're not even going to condemn you, but we're just going to ask you to leave. So he didn't keep people there. That's the big difference between Koresh and Jones. Jones had a captive audience down there, and people were afraid. And he had armed guards down there.
Yeah.
You know, and then that congressman from California, I guess some of the families complained, and he went down there, which was, I think, a bit of a mistake on his part. He should have found out what he was getting into.
Yeah.
But In any case, you know, he didn't survive down there. I think his name was Ryan. And
might be it, yeah.
Yeah, so there, you see, they say bad cases make bad law. When you have a situation of a guy like Jim Jones, you know. Now, if you look at Koresh was was an unusual individual. He was very charismatic. I would not call him a psychopath. His actions were consistent with his beliefs. He was, now, he's not the first person to allow his lower drives to take possession of him or whatever, or to distort his beliefs, you know, for his own benefit. I mean, you know, Stalin thought he was saving the Bolshevik Revolution by forcing all these people to confess and by executing hundreds and hundreds of people. I mean, I'm sure Stalin thought that this was a good thing, you know. I'm sure Stalin, you know, but the point of it is you can rationalize quite a lot of things. The fact that he killed off all his rivals, you know, well, that was you know, a secondary issue. But you know what I'm trying to talk to. I mean, religious doctrines have been distorted over the years because anything that human beings, you know, they say that humanity has fallen in a theological sense. And the human beings who are really spiritually healthy are extremely rare. And that's, you know, maybe Jesus was, you know, back 2,000 years ago, or Moses, or there are people in the communities now that are. But I believe the vast majority of humanity has a struggle, which is sometimes, at least for brief periods, a losing struggle, and commit what would be called sins or moral failings or character failings or whatever you want to call them. And, you know, but that does not make a person a psychopath.
Absolutely not.
A psychopath is the person who's being, you know, is endangering the lives of other people, who has no feeling for other people, who's, you know, who's violating the law and so on and so forth. Laws that are rational laws. I'm not talking about laws like Hitler passed, but I mean, you know, laws that are for our benefit. You know, so it's a complicated issue. And I don't know whether the people in Heaven's Gate. I had a feeling the people in Heaven's Gate were there. It seemed to be at least. I didn't get the feeling that they were being coerced to stay there.
No, I didn't either ever.
You know, and you know, he at
no,
one
that,
point there was these two people. One was called Bo, and one was called Peep. And I don't know why they gave themselves that name. In a way, Heaven's Gate reminds, you know, and it was kind of a science fictionist religion, in a way, because, you know, they seem to read.
What was it? Hale-Bopp Comet?
The Hale-Bopp Comet, yeah. They thought that they would go with them, yeah.
I did want to say, because our time's almost up, that our listeners can check out Mike McNulty did at least 3 documentaries on the Koresh and the people at Mount Carmel out of Waco. And I would suggest that people look those up because...
That's good, yeah, on YouTube, yeah.
Yeah, because he really got into it. And he didn't do the first one until about 3 years afterwards. And,
yeah.
And then like a year and a half, and then another year and a half.
Right.
One of those, it wasn't the Enquirer that rushes in, you know, how the bodies are still warm and
turns
out some kind of a thing. I mean, he did real research and with real people and talked to a lot of people. So those can give you a clearer picture of what really happened. But
yeah, and I also, before we get off, would like to recommend a book that was written by a guy who is a theologian. He's a college teacher, and let me see here for 1 second if I can get it. His name is James D. Tabor, and he wrote a book called Why Waco Cults and Something Else. But he was very, he talked to Koresh, and he has a much more sympathetic account than the you'll get in the newspapers and so on. And he understood Koresh's theology, which many, many people don't understand.
Right. So we, I think we agree that the official story really pretty much sucked. And, you know, there's a lot more to it. And people say, well,
right.
this was say, some years ago. But it's very important to what's going on now.
It can happen at any time.
Exactly. So thanks so much, Steve.
Thank you, Ruth Ann. It's always a pleasure.
Nice. Okay. See you next week. Next
month. Okay, next week.
Thursday.
Bye-bye.
Yes. Okay, bye.